This episode of Sports Spectrum's podcast with John Seidel is presented by Sports Spectrum's Weekly Slant, a brand new football show available and produced by Sports Spectrum for all of you to watch as we celebrate football and faith. You can check out Sports Spectrum's Weekly Slant every Wednesday night at 8 p.m. Eastern on our YouTube and Facebook channels or at sportsspectrum.com. It's football, it's faith. It's Sports Spectrum's Weekly Slant, a brand new show every Wednesday night, 8 p.m. Eastern, on Facebook, YouTube, and sportsspectrum.com.
Welcome to Sports Spectrum, where we bring Jesus back into the conversation. Here's your host, former ESPN producer Jason Romano.
And welcome, everyone, to the show. I am Jason. This is the Sports Spectrum Podcast. So glad that you're tuning in to our program today. Make sure you check out our website, sportsspectrum.com, for all of our content. You can sign up for our newsletter there as well. And make sure you subscribe and download and review this podcast on whatever app you're listening to the podcast on. It helps get the word out with regards to Sports Spectrum, telling someone about the intersection of sports and faith, the conversations that we're able to bring to you right here on Sports Spectrum's podcast. And we have a great conversation today with John Seidel. John is the author of a brand new book, Finding Rest, A Survivor's Guide to Navigating the Valleys of Anxiety, Faith, and Life. It released September 28th, 2021. John is a huge sports fan. He loves the Green Bay Packers, the Milwaukee Bucks. He's also a big Milwaukee Brewers fan. And John has worked with some pretty big name organizations and people, including Glenn Beck and Kirk Cameron, Chip and Joanna Gaines. He worked with I Am Second, the very popular nonprofit I Am Second, telling stories. So John's been a part of telling other people's stories for many years. Well, today he tells his own story, not just with the book that he wrote, but all that God has done and been doing in his life. This was awesome. Love talking to my friend John Seidel. I think you guys will love getting to know him and hearing about his new book, Finding Rest. It's right now on Sports Spectrum. Let's take a listen. What's up, John Seidel? How are you, buddy? Welcome to the show.
Hey, man. I am so, so glad to be here. I mean, we were talking a little bit offline before we even started here, and I think we like looked down at the clock and we're like, oh, dang, we should probably start the podcast, right?
What we talked about would probably could have been its own podcast, John, probably, if we're being honest, right?
It's just great to be talking with friends. And that's honestly been one of my favorite things about this kind of like media tour of the book is just, you know, talking with friends.
And reconnecting. And it's been great to see all that you've been doing and kind of where God has brought you to with this new book. We're going to talk about the new book, Finding Rest, in a minute. First, we got to talk about sports, and let's get the sports part out of the way here. Your fandom begins with your love for Wisconsin sports, particularly the Packers, but you're also wearing a Milwaukee Bucks hat as we record this, NBA champion Milwaukee Bucks hat.
Amen.
So you must be kind of loving life right now as a sports fan.
Well, I tell you what, I mean, I guess you can never get the full trifecta of like all your sports teams doing great. So right now it's like Bucks and Brewers, and then Packers were kind of like, well, what's gonna happen here, you know? But the Brewers being amazing, the Bucks, I was literally I flew in from Wisconsin. I live in Dallas, and so I went and visited. My brother had a wedding this weekend, and so I flew into from Wisconsin at like 1:30 this morning, and it's incredible, like going through the airport. Like, I mean, Wisconsin's a Packers, you know, state, like everything is Packers, but like to see all the Bucks gear now is pretty incredible. And so, you know, here I am as well.
I love it. Giannis has really taken over that city and embraced it. I love that he signed the max deal. I love that they won the title. If you're going to root for someone, Giannis is a guy, right? He's just amazing. And watching him kind of embrace that and grow in that role has been pretty cool.
Yeah. And there's so many other story, like Bobby Portis, right? I mean, you just love, like, the team is just full of these stories. You know, I was sad to see PJ Tucker go, but, you know, even that, like, just kind of people who are just going to grind it out and come in and be like, I'm here to work. Yes. You know, it's not about the crazy celebrity, if you will. And so it just really reflects the state, reflects, you know, what I love. And so the team just is like the quintessential Wisconsin type team for us. So,
well, here's how I knew you were a diehard. I mean, when we first met, we were talking sports right away, and you were talking about the Packers, and certainly you guys have been spoiled with Favre and then Aaron Rodgers as your quarterbacks in the last, whatever that's been, almost 30 years now. But when they won the Super Bowl, I guess that was what, 11 years ago now, Super Bowl 45, you flew to Lambeau or flew to Green Bay and went to the parade, didn't you? That told me something about the level of fandom that you have for your teams.
Yeah, I was living in New York City at the time. And so they go to the Super Bowl, and I actually flew back to Wisconsin just to watch the game with my family in Wisconsin. Because I'm like, wow. I can't not be around my people during this moment. And so, and then when we won, I actually changed my flight to stay longer to go to the parade. And ironically, the Packers and even that moment are in the book. And it's not even just like, you know, people are like, oh, were you just trying to find a way to put them in there? And it's like, no, it actually really fits a lot with what I was talking about in the book at that time. So yeah, the Packers, Reggie White. In fact, I even mentioned Sports Spectrum. I quote Sports Spectrum in the book.
You do. That was actually one of my next questions, because you tell the story about Reggie and the reference to Sports Spectrum. You got to tell that story for our audience, because obviously the connection with Sports Spectrum, and people don't know, by the way, who are listening, and I talk about it a lot, but Sports Spectrum has been around since 1985.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of archival content that go way back. And Reggie White was one of those guys that we wrote a lot about back in the early to mid 90s, especially when he got to Green Bay.
Yeah, the Minister of Defense, right? I mean,
incredible.
What an incredible guy. You know, and I was young too, so I didn't fully appreciate like free agency kind of being in its infancy around that time.
Yes.
But really, Reggie White and who he was, and unfortunately his death, had a big impact on me in understanding, you know, suffering and bad things happening to good people, the quintessential phrase.
Right.
And so when Reggie died, it was a moment for me of really being like, okay, it's, you know, here's a guy who's, I mean, he was pastoring at the time. He was pastoring when he was in Green Bay, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And if he can die young, and I grew up kind of in a theological framework that said, like, if something bad like that happens to you, you've done something wrong, or God is mad at you or punishing you, or, you know, just kind of all those things. And I remember my stepdad at the time telling me that. And I said, that just doesn't seem right. Like, that doesn't jive with what I know about Reggie White, right? I mean, he was going to Israel. The news stations were covering his like trip to the Holy Land. I remember this, like the local news station did this when him and Sarah and the kids like went to Israel, and it was like this big thing. And I'm like, that just doesn't seem to fit. And so that actually started his death is what really started me on a journey to what I talk about in the book of like a proper theology of suffering. I know that's kind of like a heady term, and I unpack it, but this idea that if something like that can happen to him, like my anxiety, my OCD, my depression, how do I make sense of that? So that was a huge event in my life.
Well, I think Reggie was maybe 44, 45, somewhere in there when he passed, maybe a little bit older or a little bit younger, but it kind of was the same when Kobe died. And it was right before COVID, and COVID happened. And it was, you know, that's all we talked about, that and all the other stuff, the political unrest, race relations, everything else in 2020. But 2020 started with Kobe's death. And I remember it hit so many people on a deeper level when Kobe Bryant died, because of him being this Superman, this invincible guy, just like Reggie White was.
Yeah.
And then suddenly in a blink of an eye, him and nine other people, including his daughter, are gone. Right. And you're like, oh my gosh, how is this supposed to happen? And people were so caught up. And I thought, man, I remember praying and talking to my brother, who's a pastor, and thinking, God, I hope you do something. I hope God does something here on people's hearts to understand that we aren't invincible.
Yeah.
That, I mean, you and I, we don't talk about that a lot, but it could happen at any point. And it will happen, by the way. It's not that it mm-hmm. could. And how do we grasp that? Because I think we are so trained as humans to fear something that we're all going to have to happen, have happen to us.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we wrestle with that? Did you see that at all with you when Kobe died as well?
So I remember sitting in my church service, mm. right? And my pastor's a big sports fan. He has his heart broken by the Houston Texans very regularly and, you know, and is a big Astros fan. And so he went from the highest of highs to the lowest of lows.
Yeah.
And he brought it up in the sermon, right? Wow. And so I think when you, and it wasn't like fitting a square peg in a round hole, but it was very similar to what you're saying, right? Of like, guys, like, you know, and I think especially with our sports heroes, if you will, we say, like, if we think we're invincible, we think they're like doubly invincible.
Oh, they're our superheroes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, and that's why, you know, I even wrote an article on the whole Simone Biles stuff recently. I think that's why when they do show vulnerability, when they do kind of, when you see that crack in the armor, it can mm-hmm. actually be a very big moment for you personally. And so I think that's what happened with Kobe. I think that's what happened with Reggie. I think even more recently that's happened with Simone and Naomi Osaka, as well, as she has become vulnerable and open. And so I think that's, it's so important for us to see that. And I think that's why, you know, listen, I know there's a lot of, you know, athletes that listen to and watch this. Like, I think that's why it's so important for them to do the same. Dak Prescott, I'm down in Dallas, right? I mean, that was a big story last year. And so, so important for them to just be like, hey guys, yeah, I am this athlete, and you know, there's a lot you don't see, but let me just be open and vulnerable, because I think it does something to us when we see that.
John Seidel is our guest here on Sports Spectrum. You were open and vulnerable as well in writing this book, Finding Rest, A Survivor's Guide to Navigating the Valleys of Anxiety, Faith, and Life. So you write this book, right? And thank you for giving me the honor to provide an endorsement for you. As
meant
people
a lot.
Go out. I appreciate that. It meant a lot that you even asked. But I believe in this book, and I believe this is something that people... it's a hidden, I don't know what the right word is to use it, but it's an issue that's hidden for a lot of people, and they don't know what to do with it. They're wrestling with it. Some are deeper in it than others. But you're talking about finding rest. I like that you use the word survivor's guide, by the way, as well.
Yeah.
Because it's almost like you are a survivor in some ways when you battle this. So why write this book? What was the nudge from God that said, you know what, I need to, because you're a writer by nature and you're a content creator and a guy who's been around and done and worked with a lot of big names and people who've created amazing, you know, platforms for themselves. But for you, why was God nudging you to write this? And why did you want to share it with everybody?
I feel like sometimes those when we say that, we feel like those are soft nudges. For me, it was kind of a big shove, if you will.
Shoved right into the locker, huh?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But you know, I would say this. So let me go back. I think growing up, I realized there was something different about me. I would have these episodes where, you know, the best way I can describe it is like where you're standing on the edge of a cliff. And you're kind of looking down and there's that, like, you know, that, oh my gosh, like something really bad could happen here, you know? Yes. And even just down to the physical aspects of your heart racing and you're sweating and, you know, you're just really on edge. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of my life. In fact, that idea, that type of attitude is, listen, I was a big football player in high school. You know, I was MVP of my team my freshman year. I remember my first game, actually, Jason, played my freshman year. I was a middle linebacker. And the coach from the other team came up to me, and my number was 54. And we're going through the line. He stops me. He pats me on the number here. And he says, man, 54, I just want to tell you, you're as tough as nails. And I was like, oh. And that was kind of the moment I was like, I'm kind of good at this, you know? Yeah. And, but because of my anxiety, I have a, especially untreated, a, like a fear of failure, a fear of letting people down, like what ifs. Yeah. I call it the tyranny of the what if. And so that is, that reigned through my life. And so by the time I got to my junior year of high school, that tyranny of the what if I'm not good enough? What if I can't carry this type of momentum through? What if the coaches, you know, I was competing with a guy whose brother like went to the school that I went to and was like a big name. And I'm like, what if they pick him over me? And I quit football. Like I quit. Right. Wow. And so those type of things were my life growing up. And so, you know, I say like, I have no idea how I finished high school or college, right, with this kind of untreated and undiagnosed. And it got to a point where it was young in my marriage. I say that like my marriage, like wasn't on the verge of falling apart. Like my marriage was falling apart because my wife was just, she was always on edge. She didn't know what would send me into an obsessive thought episode. I mean, the littlest things. And so one day we get there and, we're going to go on a walk in downtown Dallas. There's a coffee shop below our little loft. And I run to the bathroom. I say, hey, make sure that it doesn't have Splenda in it. I hate Splenda. I think it tastes like dirty sock water. Okay. And I come back, I drink the coffee. It's got Splenda in it. And I just get angry, not like punch the wall angry, but like, yeah, like all those what ifs, weird what ifs, like, you know, or just questions about like, why did she do that? Why didn't she think it was important enough to make sure, you know, just weird thing. And it just totally ruins the entire day. And so it was either that night or the next morning, I see this woman across from me who is broken and sobbing and saying like, John, like I'm here for the long haul. I'm not leaving you. Right. But you got to let me know if like, is this what I can look forward to for the rest of my life? I didn't necessarily sign up for this. I mean, my vows say I'm going to stick with you through it, but like, I really need you to get help. I really need you. Like, this is not normal. And so that was like, you know, everything kind of leading up to that, you start seeing in hindsight, like quitting football and, you know, just kind of all these obsessive thoughts that you would get on kind of came crashing down in that moment. And I said, you're right. You're right. Made a appointment with a psychiatrist. And sure enough, like, diagnoses me pretty easily and quickly with GAD, which is generalized anxiety disorder, and OCD. And OCD is a subset of anxiety.
Right.
And I'll tell you what, Jason, it was one of the most freeing days of my life. I think people are like, wait, what? Like, wouldn't you be really sad? And I said, for me, no, it was the moment I finally realized what I was fighting. It was the moment, you know, I can't fight back what I can't see. I can't fight back what I don't know is there, what I don't name, you know, otherwise I'm just, you know, swiping in the dark. Now I know what my opponent is, right? It's like, I mean, if we can make all sorts of sports analogies right here. It's like if you enter the field and you don't know who your opponent is or what they're doing or what they're, you know, you haven't studied what their game plan is or what their tendencies are. I mean, you might as well just go back into the locker room because it's a fruitless endeavor, you know,
or put a blindfold on the players and expect them to try and, you know, defend
who
they're playing.
Exactly. And so that was, you know, the long answer to your question is like, that's the moment I realized, that's when I finally was like, okay. And so there's a whole chapter called Call It By Its Name in the book of like, you know, you need to name what's going on. And I think generally us men have a harder time doing that.
Yeah.
You know, and then especially if you talk about in the sports world, and which is why I love when sports people come out, right? The Dak Prescotts of the world, the Naomi Osakas, the Simone Biles, and say, this is what I'm fighting. This is what I'm battling. Because once you name it, you can finally fight back.
And you decided to not only name it, but to write about it and to put it out there. Because it's one thing for you to know the battle that you're fighting. It's another for the world to know that you have a battle that you're fighting. Mm-hmm. What was that like? And I know that you've shared it on smaller levels on some places like social media, but to write a book like this and let everybody have an opportunity to read your story, what was the motivating factor to tell the world as opposed to just telling your inner circle or your buddies or your friends or even some people from church? That's a different, this is a different level here to let people know of what your struggle is, but that you are a survivor and now that you found rest in doing that.
I'll tell you what, there has been, and there even still are some moments of fear regarding that. And what I mean by that is when I first came out and told the world, you know, I wrote an article called Telling the World My Secret. And I was working for an organization called I Am Second at the time, which has done a lot with sports, you know, from Clayton Kershaw to, you know, you name it. And they've done stuff with them. And I remember deciding to be vulnerable and open, because that's what I Am Second is about, being vulnerable and open. And I said, you know what, if I'm working for this organization, I feel like I have to model it. And so the Lord kind of was prompting me and working on me over the course of a little bit. And then it finally came to a head one day. And so I told the world my secret. And the fear there, I think especially was, and I think a lot of people go through this, is, you know, what are people going to think? I think for me, it was also the idea that, like, I didn't want to be discounted. And what I mean by that is, I knew that past employers, I knew that current employers, I know that future employers, and then not just employers, but friends, you know, past, current, future. I didn't want to give them an excuse to just dismiss concerns that I brought up, you know, ideas that I had, hills that I felt like I needed to die on, if you will. Oh, well, that's just the anxiety talking, you know. Oh, John, are you sure this isn't just like one of your OCD moments? You know, it's like, no, I really believe like this is the path forward we need to take, right?
Yeah.
And I think even when you look at, and I think the Dak Prescott story is a great example, right? I mean, Dak comes out and I won't name names here, but, you know, there's certain people who did not, you know, opinion people who did not handle that well and question his leadership and whatnot. And it's like, that's the fear that we have, right? Right. Like what happened there with, you know, someone that rhymes with the name Chip. Like
we can
what
say
happened?
His name, Skip Bayless.
Skip Bayless. Okay, I'm just gonna say it, right?
I love Skip, but we can say his name. We know what took place there.
Right. What Skip did, I think, was just like that's the fear that we all have, right?
Yeah.
And so that still is a constant, and even in the introduction to the book, it's like that still tinges up every once in a while. But then, you know, to really answer your question is like, so then why do it if that's still there? And honestly, Jason, when I wrote that first article, seeing the reaction, the messages, the emails, the DMs, the replies that I got from people, I mean, it still makes me emotional, and I'm still getting them. The more articles I write, kind of doubling down or digging into aspects. I wrote one recently about suicide and like a letter to those considering suicide. And just this past weekend, I got, you know, I told my wife, I was at this wedding with my brother and my phone kept going off. And like, I just show my wife, I'm like, they're still coming in. Like, this is like, thank you, Lord, you know? Mm. And that's what like the Lord has really placed on my heart is, and you and I were kind of talking about this a little bit earlier before we came on, but I want to constantly be reminded that like, that is the goal, right? It's not how many sales, it's not how many followers, it's not how many interviews, right? But like truly those messages that I get from people that say, you're telling my story, thank you. Or I was suffering in silence and now I've finally been able to have the courage to name what's going on. Or, you know, and talk about this in the book, like I was ashamed to take medication. I thought that meant I was weak. And now I realize like, no, that is an actual sign of strength, you know? And I mean, there's so many rabbit trails you can go on, but like, I feel like, and especially with Simone too, is like admitting this sometimes and a lot of times takes more strength and suffering in silence because of the reactions, right?
Yeah.
Because of the Skip Baylesses of the world that kind of question your leadership. So So that's why I do it, right? The Lord has put it on my heart and said, like, these are the people, these are your people, right? These are your people. And so I want to give a voice to my people. And I want to, you know, kind of, if I am the one that can encourage them and bring the truth of the gospel of Jesus Christ into their life, like, it's worth it.
There's a lot more to what John Seidel has walked through, your own, obviously, valleys of things, of what you've been battling. But then you write chapter 3, it's called The Four Deaths. And that really takes readers deeper into not just your life, but your family's life and some of the things that you've walked through, the heartaches. Can you kind of talk about that chapter and take us through a few of those heartaches and kind of how, you know, just how you can kind of processed all of this over the past few years? And listen, we could go for another hour on some of the things that you've walked through. I do want to talk about what took place a year ago as well, as far as donating a kidney, which that's a little tease for the audience. We'll talk about that in a second, but the four deaths and kind of some real heartaches that you went through.
This is kind of one of those chapters, and Jason, you've written a couple books. Like, sometimes, like, you know, you think you have, you're like, I'm going to write this chapter and it's going to be about this. And then like something happens. You're like, oh, apparently I'm not. I'm writing about this now.
Yes.
And so within the course of about 3-4 years, you know, four of the closest people to me died. Two of them were my grandparents, who kind of explained in the book, like, I mean, who has had a picture perfect childhood, Jason? I mean, we know your story, right? But there was alcoholism in my family, and my dad left when we were young, and my stepdad came in to raise us, but that wasn't like perfect. And so my grandparents really did a lot of the raising of me. I spent so much time at my grandparents' house.
Same.
And
so, you
know, so they died, and it wasn't unexpected, right? I mean, they were in their late 80s, but that was still tough, right? And but then you put on top of that, I was, you know, driving down the road, it was close to my birthday actually here in Dallas, I was with a friend, and I get a call from my oldest sister, and she is just hysterical, and I can barely make out the words. And what I come to put together is that my other sister, who's still older than me but younger than my oldest sister, but older than me by just like a year and a half, right? So so we were very close in age. That meant we did a lot of things together. Was driving down the road, and someone crossed the center line and hit her head on, completely disintegrated the car, and she was killed instantly. And so you have that. That's a lot of questions. She had three kids. You know, the oldest was just about to turn 16, you know, when that time, and when especially, I think, as the dad of a young girl, I feel like that's even, there's even something more about that kind of coming of age time for girls and in that age. So when my niece needs her mom the most, and she's just gone. And so that was really tough. And I'll come back to kind of some of the lessons, but then, you know, a year or so later, I get a call in the height of COVID. This was April. It was Easter weekend of last year, so 2020.
Yeah.
And again from my sister, and she goes, "Hey, did you hear?" And I'm like, "Did I hear what?" Right. She goes, "Mike, my stepdad came home from work, lost consciousness. He's in the hospital. He's on a ventilator. He's not waking up." I'm like, "What?" Wow. Mike is like one of the healthiest, you know, again, going to the Reggie White thing, and it like comes back to that. Like, Mike is one of the healthiest people, you know, like just fit, runs on the beach, you know, only eats organic food.
Yeah.
Long story short, he has a massive stroke in his brainstem. Goes, you know, loses consciousness and never wakes up. And so there's a couple things, like, as I think about, and really going back even to that Reggie White thing of like, what is God doing? Like how can a good God allow these things to happen? Right. And so there's a lot that I learned from the book of Job that I talk about that's really important.
Yes.
But one thing I want to leave your audience with is, one, there's a lot of lessons I've learned, right? But here's one that I want to just completely voice and utter to you. I can't make sense of it all. Like, there's a lot that the Lord has taught me, and that's great. But like, I don't want to be the person that's up here telling you that like every lesson, every question that I've asked, every hurt that I've had has been completely answered, right? And I think that is okay to utter and say. You know, I talk about this idea of lamenting in the book, and it's something that I hadn't really, I mean, there's a book called Lamentations in the Bible, right? But I'm like, you know, before 2 years ago, I couldn't tell you what it meant to lament.
That's right.
And the idea is this. When injustice occurs, when things are not right, the process of crying out to God and saying, God, I don't understand this. Like the Psalms are a lot of laments. David saying, why, Lord, why is the bad person getting all the success? You know, why are they winning Super Bowls? Why are they winning championships? Why are they getting the promotion and making all the money? And here I am, I'm the one that's faithful to you. And my grandparents are dying. My sister's dying and my stepdad's dying, you know?
Yeah.
And what I learned is that, like, even though I haven't gotten all the answers to those questions, that process of crying out to the Lord actually brings me closer to Him. And that's where I start finding comfort and rest. And so, like, when I think about the four deaths, again, there's other lessons I've learned. But one of the big ones I want to make sure to say is that, like, I'm not here to tell you that, like a sitcom, it like everything gets figured out by the end of 30 minutes. Like, there's still things I'm working through. And I want you to know that even though that's happening, even in that process, I feel closer to the Lord. And I feel like He is holding me even tighter, even though I don't have all those questions answered. Why hasn't He miraculously taken away my anxiety and OCD? You know, like, even this is called a survivor's guide, but it's not called like an overcomer's guide, right? Like, I don't pretend like this is an ongoing battle. It's a chapter in the book. It's an ongoing battle. I still need, you know, and finding rest doesn't mean like there's still a battle, you know, I still have to go back to the battlefield, but how am I able to find rest kind of behind the lines and in those respites? So
isn't that where God kind of wants us? Now that you kind of walk through this, I feel like that's where it is. Cause I think sometimes we think we have it figured out, especially as Christians, because we've studied the Bible or we've been in church for years and kind of know Jesus as Lord and Savior. And sometimes I think He wants us to just remember that we are not Him. We don't have anything figured out sometimes, other than He wants our undeniable attention, trust, and love to be focused on Him, not on anything that we can accomplish. I know that's cliche in some ways too, but that's kind of where I think He wants us all to be. And unfortunately, sometimes He uses a situation like what you went through, John, to kind of remind us all of that. Do you see that?
Absolutely. And so, you know, I had kind of grown up hearing this story of like Paul has this like thorn in his flesh, right? Yeah. And you're like, oh, what's this all about, right? And so I was talking to a friend the other day and kind of talking through this concept of like, listen, like the Lord can like allows us to continue to struggle sometimes because He, like you said, He knows it's best for us. And like in the moment, that's really hard to say, right? Like your sister gets killed in a car accident. That's not her fault. And you see, you know, I did this thing and I still haven't fully looked at him. Like I filed a Freedom of Information Act request and I got like crime scene photos, if you will. Yeah. I looked at some of them, but I haven't looked at all of them. But like when you're looking at those pictures and you see your sister's leg hanging out of a disintegrated car,
right?
Like to say like, well, the Lord is going to use that. Like, I know that's not comforting in the moment and I don't pretend for it to be. But
sure.
Once you kind of get further away from that, you can't let my promise to you is as if you are someone who is going through a struggle is like you can and you will get to that point. But yes, the Lord gave, you know, Paul this thorn in his flesh. And I told someone, you know what I started to realize is like, maybe without my struggle, maybe without these deaths in my life, like I could be maybe I'm the most prideful person this world has ever seen. You know, like maybe I am so full of my accomplishments and I am so full of myself and I would never, ever give credit to God. But because of this, like, I've been humbled. You know, there's that line, and I even rant about this a little bit in the book of like people say, don't pray for humility. God might give it to you. And I'm like, no, like if I pray for humility and God humbles me, that means I needed to be humbled, right? Like that means I apparently am a really selfish person. So heck yeah, I'm going to pray for humility, you know? Absolutely. And so I think that, you know, I'm a big, big fan of C.S. Lewis. And so I, you know, if people in your audience haven't read his stuff, it is life. I literally named my son after him because he's been so influential in my life. I didn't name him Clive. His nickname was Jack. So I named my son Jack. But you know, he talks about this idea of like how the Lord like shouts to us in our pain. Right. And it's his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. And I think the Lord is good enough to use our struggles and the thorns in our flesh to wake us up and remind us that we absolutely, absolutely need him.
Yeah. I think that's where God does his, if I'm putting a best, you know, kind of label on it, I think it's when he does his best work is when we're all in the struggle. It really is. It's what you hear that too, right? It's like turning a test into a testimony, or, you know, processing the pain. It's cliche to use those, and people have created what they've created, but it's true. Like, I think it's the best work is done when we're going through it. And then we can come out on the other side and just look back and say, yep, that was what I needed. And that's where God was really with us. Cause he doesn't promise that we won't go through it. He just promises us that he will be with us as we do go through it. And that's really,
in this world, you will have troubles, right? Like that's the promise of our Savior. And to your point, I will say this, like I think there are a lot of cliches, and I think like you, like I'm very hesitant on those because I think they tend to trivialize, but I think one of the greatest detriments that those little like corny cliche phrases have is that like, there are truths under there.
Oh, right? Most of them are true. There's a reason they're a cliche.
Right, yeah. Exactly. And yet, but I think so many times we don't have we're not willing to sit with people in their pain, right? So instead we just kind of throw them like a little phrase, and that's what feels saccharine. That's what feels fake.
Yeah.
And so like, if we're willing to sit with people in their pain, like, and then kind of describe that truth that's underlying that cliche, it's like, oh no, that really is true.
That's really good.
Yes.
Finding Rest is the name of the book, A Survivor's Guide to Navigating the Valleys of Anxiety, Faith, and Life. John Seidel is the author. He's our guest here. He's also my good friend, and I'm glad that you are willing to share your story with us, John. Real quick, before we let you go, you talked about serving others as a form of helping you through anxiety and COVID. And you mentioned that, and not COVID, but OCD. And during COVID, it happened to be October 14th, 2020, speaking of COVID, last year, where you served in the most incredible way by donating a kidney. So give us that story real quick, because that's such a cool story too, especially knowing that you came off of what you just described, these four deaths, and suddenly you have this opportunity to give life to someone else in such an unbelievably cool way. Take us through what took place.
So about, man, I want to say 2.5-3 years ago, I'm sitting in my office and my dad posts something on Facebook that says he has a friend that needs a kidney and the person has to have like O type O blood. And if you're interested, fill out this form. My stepdad, who was alive at the time, was a kidney recipient. So when I was growing up, he was on dialysis 3 times a week. Like, you know, it's not just an analogy to say it sucked the life out of him, but dialysis literally sucks the blood out of your body, filters it through a machine and puts it back in. So it literally sucked the life out of him, you know, figuratively and literally. And I know what that was like to be a family member of someone. You're just waiting. You're waiting for a donor. You're waiting for someone to come forward. And eventually his sister did come forward after initially not getting tested, because it can be a scary process. And so I'm sitting there looking at that post and not like, and I don't say this to build myself up, because it actually, when I went home, wasn't a good idea, but I just like, oh, I'm O blood. My dad's friend needs a kidney. Like, let me just fill out this form, blah, blah, blah. And, you know, type it in, send it out. So I get home and my wife goes, like, you know, ask me the quintessential, like, how was your day? I'm like, oh, you know, sent it, you know, emails, blah, blah, blah. Oh, and by the way, I signed up to be a kidney donor. And she's like, excuse me? I'm like, I don't recommend signing up to be a kidney donor. And the first conversation you have with your wife is telling her that you've already signed up to be a kidney donor.
Yeah.
But so we worked through that, you know, because I had an understanding of, like, it can be a scary process, but having been on the other side of it, a little bit more understanding of what it all entails. And long story short, that person that I sign up for, there's one other person in front of me in line. That person ends up being a match. They don't need me. But that recipient had gotten to know some other people within the kidney, you know, world, if you will. Said, hey, there's this guy in Mississippi. He's got 5 kids. And he cannot find a donor. Would you just be willing to sign up for him on the off chance that you might be a match? And I said, yeah, absolutely. Again, long story short, we go through the process. I'm a match. This guy, the stranger, I'd never met him. I knew his name was Ken. His wife was named Deborah. And that's about it, right? Lives in Mississippi. And we get through the process and we're about to, like, schedule the surgery. And Ken's kidney failure happened because of diabetes. Ken happens to be a Black man, and, you know, diabetes is much more rampant in the Black community. And all of a sudden, like, he starts having to get extremities amputated. It starts with his toes, his feet, goes all the way up to his knees. And so our donation was put completely on hold as he tried to heal from this. So finally, in the summer of 2020, we're like, we're ready to go. We need to schedule it. I come in, I'm a little overweight, and they're like, you need to lose this weight. You know, so I, like, hire a personal trainer to shed these pounds and be able to make, I kind of felt like a fighter, right? I'm like, I got to cut weight. I got to make weight here. You know? I'm Jason, I'm not kidding you. The day that I, like, had to check in for the surgery. So I fly down to New Orleans. I meet Ken for the first time. It's amazing.
Yeah.
But, like, that morning they have to do, like, my final weigh-in. I literally put on sweatshirt and sweatpants and I'm running stairs in the hotel. I'm like, all right, I'm shedding weight. I did wrestling for 1 week in high school and I was like, I ain't doing this. This sucks.
Yeah, you know? It's brutal. Yeah.
Yeah. But I felt like I was, like, that 1 week back in wrestling. I'm like, you know, sweating my, you know what, off. Oh. And I make weight. And so the surgery happens and it was an incredible, incredible experience. I would not change it for the world to see. And it kind of came full circle just a couple months ago where Deborah, Ken's wife, sends me a picture. See, Ken had prosthetics, but he wasn't able to use them because he was so tired from the dialysis that he was never able to basically, like, practice and learn how to use his prosthetics. So he had been in a wheelchair ever since he had his legs amputated. And not only that, so she sends me this video and it's Ken walking. Like, he's walking in his prosthetics for, like, the first time in years. Wow. And then she, you know, she told me that he had spent the last 5 years sleeping in a recliner. He could not sleep in his own bed because the way that the kidneys, you know, work is they filter fluid. And when he would lay down in his bed, the fluid would build up and he would basically swell up and he couldn't get out of bed. So this guy had to sleep in a recliner for 5 years. So now we get to the point where, like, he's walking and he's sleeping in his own bed. And I don't say any of that to, like, boast myself up. I say that because, like, Jason, like, I am the chief of sinners, right? Like, the fact that the Lord would use me, right? Like, that he would use me, an imperfect person, to help someone like that, like, blows my mind. Like, I'm not the perfect person. Please don't, like, see me as that. Your audience that's listening, don't see me as, like, this hero because I gave a kidney. Like, I, like, the fact that the Lord used me in that way, despite my failings and my shortcomings and, you know, the things that can come out of my mouth sometimes, just ask my wife. The fact that he could use me in that way is, like, testament that, like, he can use anyone. And so that's really what I love, the lesson I love conveying in this whole story is like God can use broken people to accomplish some amazing, amazing things.
Yeah. And this is a surgical procedure that you have to make a decision on going through as well. And I'm sure for you, there's some fear, speaking of that word again, but also you have to recover too, right? Like you have a major surgery on donating one of your kidneys. So now you have one kidney, not two. How was your recovery? Was it pretty smooth? I mean, clearly you're doing well because we're having this conversation, but that was a year ago. What was that like for you real quick to go through that?
There's two things that I feel like they told me about, but they didn't fully prepare me for. My wife says, I now know what it's like to have a baby. And I said, well, what do you mean? Jason, so they pump you full of a lot of pain meds and kind of stuff like that. And that causes quite the constipation. And one of the biggest things for me was in the few days I had to stay in New Orleans for like three days. Okay. Because the transplant happened in New Orleans. I had to stay in New Orleans in a hotel. And I'm telling you what, like the process of going to the bathroom after being pumped with all that stuff was it like insane. I did not. And my wife was like, yeah, that's what we women have to go through. Right. So that was uncomfortable, but honestly, like what was really interesting. So I have they go through your abdomen to get back toward your kidney. You'd think, oh, do they go through your back? No, they go through the front to get at the back, which is part of the reason why you have to make sure to make weight because it gives them less to have to go through. And I didn't realize like everything they have to cut to go through. So the constipation was bad. Mm-hmm. And then my back, I had back spasms that were the most painful thing that I've had ever in my life. I mean, I tore my knee in high school playing football, not as bad as these back spasms, because apparently like my core was so compromised that my back was trying to make up for it. Mm. And I remember there was one time where my wife, she grabbed a Nalgene bottle and she filled it up with water and she would heat it up to almost boiling in the microwave. And for like 3 days, I just sat with a hot Nalgene, just like rolling out my back. All that to say though, like after about a week and a half, I mean, I was still walking slow, but the recovery was, you know, testament to the Lord, right? Like was a lot better than I thought. Like after a month, I was back in the gym.
That's good.
Working out just like slowly. And, but all that to say, like, I still like, even though there was that pain, even though apparently I know what it's like to be like after you give birth, I would not change it for the world.
Yeah, it was worth it, right? No doubt.
Yeah.
That's amazing. John, this has been great. Last question, and this is going to require you to answer this in a short amount of time, because again, this question could be a huge podcast. But this is a question I've been asking a lot of guests lately, and it's different than the question that we used to ask. It's not spiritual at all, although it might be, depending on how you describe it. What is John Seidel's perfect sports day? You could pick any day. Doesn't have to be something that's already taken place. Just if somebody said, John, I want to give you the perfect day of sports, what would you do?
So it definitely involves the Packers.
I figured that. And Lambeau Field, I'm guessing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think perfect sports day would be, it's not a primetime game, right? So it's going up to Lambeau and it is, you know, I've gone to plenty of Packer games and like the tailgating scene in Lambeau is just, it's just incredible. It's like nothing else.
It's unbelievable. Yeah.
And even like to visiting fans, right? Like, you know, if you're a visiting fan and you're walking from the parking lot to Lambeau and you don't get offered an adult beverage, like something's wrong. Like you're still offered that, you know? So it involves going up to Lambeau. It would definitely involve, you know, some like, not just like 50 yard line seats, but I'd definitely be on the sideline, you know, meeting the team. And and then watching at noon, because I grew up watching a lot of like the noon, you know, in Central Time, one Eastern, the noon kickoff games. And like that for some reason is like always burned into my mind, right? Like primetime games are great, but like noon kickoff at Lambeau is just incredible. And so watching them, and I'll say this, it would involve a noon kickoff, watching the Packers beat the Buccaneers and not kick a field goal and instead go for it and win the game. So that would be my perfect sports day is just being up there, you know, with the team on the sideline, enjoying a Packers win at on noon kickoff game.
That's a great sports day. I might have to come with you if you want to go. That would be an amazing sports day, John.
Listen, I will say this real quickly. I'm at this family's wedding, and part of the way I always get tickets is my mom's cousin was willed tickets, you know, because it's 50 years or whatever.
Oh, yeah. The waiting list is incredible.
Right. And so he would always, like, if I wanted a game, he'd always at least sell me two tickets. And so I'm at the wedding, and I like have my dates. I'm like, okay, so Jim, here are the dates I want. And he goes, hey, I got rid of the tickets. And I like literally had a moment where I was like, I'm going to slap you upside the head, brother. Oh. I was like, I would have probably sold my other kidney, you know, not that I didn't sell the first one. But like, I probably would have sold the other one. He's like, it's just, you know, the seat fees and blah. I'm like, Jim, I would have found a way. So I was so bummed. So now my inside access to tickets is gone. So I feel like I don't know what I'm going to do, Jason. I don't know.
You're a regular old pedestrian.
I know.
StubHub.com or something, right?
Yeah, right.
Oh, John. Listen, congrats, man. Congrats on the new book, Finding Rest. People need to go read it and hear your story and read really about a survivor's guide, as you write about in the subtitle, navigating the valleys of anxiety, faith, and life. We all need to kind of navigate through some of that. And your book does a good job with that. So congrats on the book. People need to go read it. And thanks for joining us, buddy.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. People can go to findrestnow.com if they want to get all the information.
Findrestnow.com. You got it. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
And many thanks to John Seidel for joining us here today on Sports Spectrum. Findrestnow.com is the website you can go to learn more about John's book, Finding Rest, and some of the resources that he has available there. But really, this book is one you're going to want to go pick up, not just because it will help you in your journey, but John's story is one that is just a powerful one to read, and he writes it beautifully in his new book, Finding Rest. So go pick it up. Check out the website, findrestnow.com, and let's support my friend John Seidel and his new book, Finding Rest. Thanks to John for joining us here today on the show. Thanks to you as well for listening and tuning in to this podcast. Do us one favor on your way out. Not only clicking that subscribe button, as I mentioned in the beginning, so that you don't miss any episodes here, but please just tell someone about Sports Spectrum. Maybe it's this conversation. Maybe it's another conversation. Maybe it's an article from our website. Maybe it's the magazine. But tell someone about Sports Spectrum. I'm sure you know someone who loves sports and maybe has an interest in faith or religion or Jesus, but maybe they don't. This is a resource. That's how we look at Sports Spectrum. We are a resource for you to share the gospel with someone else who loves sports, and we're using sports as a gateway to share with people about Jesus. So tell someone about Sports Spectrum, maybe it's this podcast or another, and just let them know about the work that we're doing here, and maybe it encourages them on their journey with God. Thanks for tuning in again, and we'll see you next time right here on Sports Spectrum's podcast. Have a great rest of your day. Stay safe, and we'll see you soon.